Welcome to Managing MDS. My name is Doug Smith, and I am a professor of oncology at the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins. And today we're going to talk about myelodysplastic syndromes, and specifically I want to talk to you about the low-risk patients, how to individualize your therapies in hopes of keeping them as low-risk patients. There's a couple of objectives that we want to achieve today. One is I'd like to summarize the disease characteristics and appropriate therapies for patients with lower risk disease, specifically those with and without 5q deletions. I'd like to describe the importance of individualizing therapies and talk to you about strategies that may impact disease progression. And finally, I'd like to talk to you about a couple of different treatment practices, namely growth factors, immunosuppressive agents, the IMIDs, and demethylating agents. So as many of you know, myelodysplastic syndromes are really clonal bone marrow malignancies that are really akin to malignancies of the bone marrow. There's approximately 15 to 25,000 new cases a year in the U.S., and these bone marrow failure disorders result in peripheral cytopenias and eventually poor bone marrow function. The median age of this group of patients really closes in on 70, and so it's important to understand our therapeutic options in this older populations. As you can see from the slide below, that at almost every age group, men outnumber women with this disorder. You can also see from this graph that this is a disease of older patients, and as the population ages, we do expect more and more cases of myelodysplastic syndromes to reveal themselves. Now, this is a very complicated slide trying to sort of outline the pathophysiology or the pathobiology of myelodysplastic syndrome. And I don't think it's important to understand all of the nuances, but I do think it's important to understand that myelodysplastic syndromes, these disorders are progressive. They generally get worse over time, and like every other malignancy that we know of, they accumulate genetic mutations, and these genetic mutations result in the disease becoming more aggressive and more advanced. Now, what we know is that because of this progressive nature of myelodysplastic syndromes, that most patients will end up succumbing to their bone marrow failure disorder. About 1 in 3 patients with myelodysplastic syndrome will actually transition or evolve into an acute myeloid leukemia. Now, over the past 20 years, the therapies for myelodysplastic syndromes have really evolved tremendously. Early on, we only really had growth factors and transfusions that were supportive in nature to try to keep patients going as long as possible. The extreme therapy that was available included an allogeneic stem cell transplant, which we all understand as being, highly successful, but unfortunately it's highly toxic and a lot of our older patients are not good candidates for a transplant. However, in the year 2016, there are a series of therapies that are available for patients with MDS, and specifically, there's several drugs that have now been approved by the FDA to treat myelodysplastic syndromes. I've noted here on the slide, there's best supportive care that still is the mainstay for treatment of patients with MDS. Immunosuppressive therapies, such as ATG and cyclosporin, these therapies are very important for certain subtypes of myelodysplastic syndrome. Immunomodulatory drugs, the IMIDs, like lenalidomide, is a very important drug. And the hypomethylating agents, or the DNA methyltransferase inhibitors, azacitidine and deoxyazacitidine, are again another treatment approach that we can use for patients with myelodysplastic syndromes. So when we think about MDS and our treatment approaches, I think it's very important to take a step back and understand that we have prognostic tools that help us determine whether a patient has a high-risk disease or a lower-risk disease. And I've shown you the most common and the best known prognostic tool, the International Prognostic Scoring System, that uses bone marrow blast percentage, the number of lineages affected by the myelodysplastic syndrome, and of course the cytogenetic abnormalities to try to create a score for patients to determine what the likelihood of how well they'll do would be. Now, the IPSS was developed in the time when there were not medical, there's not good medical management or not good drugs to treat this disorder. And so, in fact, when we look at survival curves and progression curves, so progression to acute myeloid leukemia curves, we can see that those with high-risk disease, the outcome is very, very poor, median survival of less than half a year. Whereas those with very low-risk disease, the median survival is 5 or 6 or almost 7 years in some cases. Likewise, high-risk patients very commonly transition or transform to acute leukemia, where low-risk patients almost never do. So if we use the IPSS or a prognostic scoring system as a means to begin to think about our patients, we can then start to think about goals for therapy. Now, what's important to understand is when newly diagnosed patients, the vast majority of them turn out to be lower risk patients. And what I mean by lower risk specifically is a low risk or intermediate one by the IPSS scoring system. And when I think about these patients, I think the goals of our therapy are really to try to improve the bone marrow function, lower transfusion needs, and really decrease the impact that myelodysplastic syndrome has on patients' quality of life. It's very important, as one of the goals is to establish a good, careful monitoring plan and do everything that we can to try to prevent progression of the disease. Higher risk patients that end up having very poor prognosis, the goals of therapy are very different. One needs to work very hard to stabilize the bone marrow function for the patient and do everything that they can to move that patient into a therapy for long-term management. Some patients are candidates for allogeneic stem cell transplant. The majority of those that go to stem cell transplant are really in the high-risk group of patients. So I go back to the slide looking at the therapies that are available for patients with low-risk disease, and I block them into two separate groups. I'll talk about each therapy a little bit individually, but I want you to know that conceptually, when I think of supportive care, I think of things like transfusions, growth factor support, and immunosuppressive agents such as ATG and cyclosporin. But when I think of some of the medications that we have available to treat low-risk MDS, like the IMIDs and like the DNA methyltransferase inhibitors, I think of these drugs as potentially being able to alter the disease biology. And if they're used properly, the hope would be that one would hold off progression, hold off a bone marrow failure state, and really impact the patient's overall survival. So let's go through these one by one and talk briefly about them. So best supportive care, namely growth factor support and transfusions. The vast majority of patients with myelodysplastic syndrome will eventually require transfusion support, either red blood cell transfusion support or platelet transfusion support. And what we know is that the bone marrow is sent signals by naturally occurring proteins in the body that drive the production of the white blood cells, red blood cells, and the platelets. And hematopoietic growth factors are simply synthetic versions of these proteins that are administered to patients to try to drive and improve their bone marrow function. We have growth factors for red blood cells, white blood cells, and more recently, we've been studying growth factors to improve platelet counts. It's important to recognize while these drugs are very, very important and they're very, very effective at driving red cell, white cell, or platelet growth, none of them are really FDA approved in the setting of myelodysplasia. Now, we do use these drugs commonly, and what I'd like to share with you is when we look at the most commonly used growth factor for MDS, that would be erythropoietin-stimulating agents. And there are models that one can use to try to help sort out whether a patient's likely to respond to a drug like ESA, erythropoietin-stimulating agents, or not. Here's a very simple model, namely the patient's own endogenous erythropoietin level. If it's low, it's a very likely chance that patients will respond to adding some erythropoietin back. The number of transfusions patients have needed, again, very important in determining whether they're likely to respond. And in using this model, you can see that There are some patients that you'll use erythropoietin for that will have a very, very low chance of responding. For the most part, we don't use erythropoietin in those patients. However, in the group with higher scores that are able to most likely respond to the drugs, this is a very common way that we would try to improve people's bone marrow function. There are problems with erythropoietin, and one just needs to be aware that in several solid tumor studies, these drugs have been associated with worse outcomes for patients. And specifically, efforts to drive the red cell count too high, it has not been associated with improving outcomes. In fact, it's been shown to have worse outcomes for patients with head and neck cancers and certain other tumor types where this has been studied. White blood cells and platelet growth factors, again, are commonly used with patients with myelodysplasia. I've come to a very simple rule that I do not treat a number, but rather I treat a symptom. If a patient's having difficulty with recurrent infections and often has low white blood cell counts, I will periodically use the white cell growth factors to try to improve the bone marrow function and make that number better. Same with platelets. If patient is persistently low or is refractory to transfusions and has bleeding problems, I think it's not unreasonable to consider using a drug to stimulate the platelet growth to try to keep the patients out of that danger zone. Again, I remind people these aren't approved for this indication, but are clinically effective and can be used in the right setting. So what about immunosuppressive agents? Well, we've known for a long time that there are forms of myelodysplastic syndrome that it seem to involve the immune system, an overactive immune system. And using drugs that suppress the immune system have been effective at normalizing the bone marrow function. And the most famous combination is anti-thymocyte globulin, or ATG, and cyclosporin A. And here I'll show results from a phase 3 study. 88 patients, which is not large for typical solid tumor phase 3 study, but for this rare form of myelodysplasia that's manifest by a hypocellular marrow, they looked at 88 patients, and they saw that as compared to best supportive care, ATG cyclosporin resulted in remission rates of up to 30%. There were predictors that suggested that which groups may or may not respond. Importantly, this therapeutic strategy is often used for patients that have hypocellular forms of myelodysplastic syndrome. And there are certain HLA types like DR15, which predict a better response to immunosuppressive therapies. Now, when I think about the last two treatment approaches that remain, the IMIDs and the demethylating drugs, I do like to think of these as potentially disease-modifying drugs, and I'll share a little bit about that with you. First, lenalidomide, an IMID. Now, lenalidomide is a really important drug for the treatment of myelodysplastic syndrome. And specifically, it's interesting because we're not 100% sure of how it works. It does modulate T cells. It affects their proliferation, their growth, and their production of cytokines. However, it's also an anti-angiogenesis factor. Now, lenalidomide has been studied in lower risk patients, namely patients with red cell transfusion needs. Lenalidomide, or the IMID family, is really good at improving erythropoiesis and really affects red blood cell counts more than it does the other lineages. And this is a study schema from a two-armed study looking at lenalidomide as a single agent. And specifically, it's important to understand that all the patients had to have low-risk disease by the IPSS criteria. They had to have fairly preserved platelets. They had to have relatively few transfusion needs. And ultimately, there were two arms. One arm that focused on patients with the deletion 5q, which is a well-known factor that predicts responsiveness to lenalidomide, as well as the second arm, which patients were low risk but did not have to have the 5q deletion. The plan randomized patients between 10 milligrams of the drug every day or 10 milligrams 21 out of every 28 day cycles. And what they found, looking at the two different groups, is that if patients that had the 5q deletion had an incredible response rate of over 66% becoming transfusion independent. This happened very quickly, median time to the response of about 4.5 weeks. Patients with low risk disease but without the 5q minus also had a very nice response, with 25% of them becoming transfusion independent, also very, very quickly. So this the effectiveness of this drug had really not been seen before in patients with low-risk disease, and the ability to make people transfusion independent was a very, very powerful clinical outcome. You can see that in this survival curve, a Kaplan-Meier estimate is how long did people remain transfusion independent. And again, this goes out, the median time is beyond beyond a year and a half. And ultimately, what we've discovered is that those patients that respond nicely to lenalidomide are often able to have very prolonged responses, but over time, as one might expect, the responses become fewer and fewer. One thing that needs to be noted is that lenalidomide is an orally available drug and patients take it at home, but it has a pretty significant impact on the remaining bone marrow function. And one needs to be aware that the most common early side effect is really cytopenias. In fact, in early clinical trials looking at lenalidomide, some of the studies showed that up to 80% of patients needed to be dose reduced in the early going in order to avoid significant and troubling cytopenias. So when one treats a patient with lenalidomide, one also has to keep in the back of their mind that, that transfusions and cytopenias are an important side effect of this drug. I had the opportunity to work with a couple of my colleagues as well as a database team to look backwards retrospectively and try to understand how we could maximize lenalidomide's effect through dosing manipulation. And the study really looked retrospectively at real-world outcomes of patients who were treated with lenalidomide. We looked at a database and we basically asked a question of how many of those patients needed to be dose-modified, and when patients were dose-modified, was there a difference in outcomes between those we stopped the drug in, those we lowered the dose of the drug in, those patients who we were able to continue on and manage them. You can see that we looked at over 500 and almost 40 patients to try to do this analysis. And I'll show you an important curve. And this curve basically said is those patients where we stopped the treatment because of cytopenias versus those patients where physicians chose to modify the dose of lenalidomide had distinctly different outcomes. Not only was the relationship between the duration of therapy extended, but there was an improved time to transforming to leukemia, a longer time to the next planned therapy, and a longer time to transitioning to a higher risk disease if you dose modified. And so what my colleagues and I have sort of taken from this retrospective look at real-world data is that physicians who manipulate the dose of lenalidomide have an opportunity to not only keep their patients on the drug longer, but to get some clinical benefit from that. Namely, patients do better, they remain on therapy a lot longer, the likelihood of them transitioning to higher risk disease or acute leukemia is lower. And so for that reason, we've come to understand that drugs like lenalidomide appear to alter disease biology, and using good clinical strategies to maintain the right patients on trial seems to be an important thing for outcome. So finally, I'd like to turn my attention to the hypomethylating drugs, or the DNA methyltransferase inhibitors, namely 5-azacitidine and D-cytidine. Again, I view these drugs as potentially disease-modifying, and if we use them correctly, the goal will be to maintain a disease stability in patients longer. Now, hypomethylating drugs have been studied for over into two decades now. And these drugs, here shown the chemical structures of each, are really cousins of each other. One's called 5-azacitidine and the other one's called deoxy 5-azacitidine. And you can see that the chemical structure is sort of a missing a hydroxyl group in the decitabine. And what's important to understand is the mechanism of action of these drugs is not completely understood, but they seem to work by differentiating cells over time. And they do this through normalization of gene expression in the MDS cells, if you will. Now, these drugs have classically been used for patients with high-risk myelodysplastic syndrome. However, there's been a very, very nice study looking at different ways to use these drugs to try to improve patients with transfusion needs. And these patients were not required to be high-risk patients, but they just were required to be on the study to need transfusions. And there were three different arms planned for this. This is using the drug azacitidine, where patients could receive the drug 5 days in a row, take the weekend off, and receive 2 more days of the drug the following week. This repeated every 28 days. One could take a lower dose of the drug daily for 5 days, take the weekend off, and treat for 5 more days. Or use the standard dose of the drug, 75 per meter squared, 5 days in a row, and call it a day. The goal of this was to see who we could improve blood counts in, who we could improve transfusion needs in using treatment schedules that were conducive to outpatient management. As you know, that the original dosing for 5-azacitidine was 7 days in a row, which is not necessarily convenient for outpatient care. I'll show you a very busy table which shows the improvement in blood counts with each of the schedules. And one can note a couple of important things. Number one, there were erythroid, there were platelet, and there were neutrophil improvements seen in all study schedules. But what's really seemed to stand out is that over half the patients, or at least half the patients in each of the groups, became transfusion independent using one of the schedules. The 5-day schedule, which was 75 per meter squared of the azacitidine given daily for 5 days, seemed to do the best as far as transfusion independent, but the groups were not big enough to prove that this was a statistically different amount. Suffice it to say that the demethylating drugs can impact both red cells, white cells, and platelet counts, but when you're looking to try to improve transfusion needs, these are very effective drugs in patients that require a red cell transfusion. Now, I mentioned to you that these drugs might be sort of disease or biology modifying drugs. And where I get this notion is really from the AZO-001 study. This is a fairly complicated study done in higher risk patients. The study was really designed to pit standard treatments versus azacitidine in a randomized trial. And the idea was that physicians could pick what they would consider standard for their practice, either supportive care, low doses of Ara-C, or traditional Ara-C given in combination with an anthracycline, like you were treating a patient with acute leukemia. And whatever predetermined standard treatment was then randomized against azacitidine. And you can see this is a very large randomized study of high-risk MDS patients, about 180 patients per arm. And what they found was that when they looked at the outcomes, survival outcomes for patients who were randomized to azacitidine compared to one of the other standard treatment arms, patients actually did better, survived longer when they were randomized to the 5-azacitidine arm. Here you can see at 2 years there was a near doubling of survival. One of the criticisms of this study was that most of the patients received best supportive care as the doctor's physician's choice. And so most of the time the randomization took place of azacitidine versus a best supportive care. So it wouldn't be hard to expect azacitidine to beat the standard of care. However, they did a post study analysis, which looked specifically at removing the best responders. So here you can see survival curves where they've taken out anybody that's achieved a complete remission. And again, if you look at 2 years, you can see a near doubling of survival. If you take out even patients with complete remissions and partial remissions, so the best responders in each arm, to really try to level the playing field between the best supportive care patients and the azacitidine patients, it turns out you still get a nearly doubling of 2-year survival, which again led many of the investigators and many of the clinicians who use this drug, this class of drugs a lot, to understand and believe that these agents, the demethylating drugs, are somehow changing disease biology, where patients not only survive better, but even patients who are not getting a traditional complete or partial response appear to be living longer than those patients who were treated with either best supportive care or traditional chemotherapy-based regimens. So again, the thinking and the mindset is that in some of the therapies that we're using are supportive in nature, but there are others that may change the biology and really impact patients' survival. So in conclusion, when one thinks about myelodysplastic syndromes and specifically patients with low IPSS score or low risk MDS, the important factor is to try to keep them in the low risk disease group. In the year 2016, we have effective therapies. You know, we use the IPSS to really help us stratify to patients who needs immediate therapy, who needs supports, and who has goals of just trying to maintain disease stability. Ultimately, I think growth factors and immunosuppressive agents do play a role in treating myelodysplastic syndrome. I think they're very, very good supports. Allogeneic transplant, although we did not speak about it much today, I think it does play an important role for patients. Typically, we reserve the use of allogeneic stem cell transplant for patients with higher risk disease or patients progressing out of lower risk disease. But when one thinks about the therapies that we use to try to maintain patients in low risk disease status, I specifically think about the IMIDs, like lenalidomide. The goal is to improve transfusions. And if you're smart, dose modify when you can. Ultimately, we think that more patients will benefit from longer duration of therapy, less likelihood of transforming to acute leukemia. With drugs like azacitidine and decitabine, again, it's very important. Not only do these drugs improve bone marrow function, but they've been shown to improve survival, even in the setting where a complete response was not seen. I really thank you for viewing this activity. As you'll note, there's additional resources available and other educational activities at managingmds.com. And I thank you for your attention.